May it please the court. My name is Brent Westerfeld. I represent Constantino Cejas. The issue which I wish to speak to is the question presented is does his second conviction for possession of a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense violate double jeopardy or the intent of Congress with regard to 924C1, given that his possession, given that the evidence showed possession of a gun over a continuous period of time, in this case 6 days. Mr. Cejas was charged with conspiracy to commit dealing in methamphetamine, and then two substantive counts of delivery or possession with intent to deliver methamphetamine, one occurring on February the 8th and one occurring on February the 14th. The government also alleged two counts of violation of 924C1, possession of a firearm in furtherance of those two actual possessions with intent to deliver. It is significant that the indictment did not allege either carrying or use of the firearm. It was strictly possession in furtherance of drug trafficking. Mr. Cejas was employed, worked as a security officer, and carried a gun in regard to that. The first offense occurred on February 8th when he was seen at the residence of Mr. Denny driving what they referred to as an old police car, which was really a security company car that looked like a police car. Police followed him to a location and observed that he had a holstered gun when he got up from a table. The second time, he was in a truck with his brother again at the Denny residence, and he was then stopped by police officers, and the gun was found on his person. The government submits that the possession and furtherance language in 924C is no different than the carry and use language in 924C. We submit that it is. This is akin to the felon in possession of firearm language. Possession is a passive.
Actually, we've held to the contrary in the Kappas case that the unit of prosecution here is the underlying drug deal, not the
I think there's some difference of opinion among the circuits as to that unit of prosecution, and it especially occurs when it's this, when the allegation is this possession in furtherance. For example, a drug trafficker has weapons at his home or his place of business, and he goes out and sells drugs one day, sells drugs another day. Under the government's interpretation of the statute, he could be charged with possession and furtherance of each of those drug trafficking offenses,
right,
regardless of the amount of time that came in between them.
Right, that's what the statute says. This is different from felon in possession, which is a status-based crime.
I understand.
This is an act-based crime.
It has more to do with the definition of possession, okay? The government is saying possession is like carrying or usage, and we submit it's really a passive state. If you have a gun, if a drug trafficker has a gun at his place or several firearms, we typically have this testimony that is a tool of the trade. And so under the government's interpretation of the statute, each time he delivered drugs, if they charge him with that, he could be charged with this possession in furtherance. We submit that that's not what Congress intended. What Congress intended was to punish one time for one possession, even though there may be multiple trafficking offenses.
There's nothing in the language of the statute to support that interpretation. The statute punishes use or carrying of a firearm during and in relation to a crime of violence or a drug trafficking crime. That obviously punishes the act of carrying during the predicate drug trafficking offense, and the object is is different than that in the felon in possession statute, which is, again, a status-based crime.
But if you look, I understand. But if you look at closely at the statute, the relation to or during language goes with the use and carrying language. In regard to the possession, it's possession in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense. In other words, Congress used different language when it described the possession offense and talked about it being in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense. And as we submit, that there's something incongruous that a person who possesses a gun passively, and they may be away from their house, they may be away from their employment, the gun may be in another location, that under the government's interpretation, each time he sold a drug, even though the gun is not with him, he's not carrying it, not using it, he could be liable under their interpretation of the statute multiple times for 924C1 each time he committed a predicate drug crime.
And essentially, that's what we said in Palladino, where we held that two separate drug crimes committed on the same day, each involving a gun, constituted separate 924C violations.
Palladino was a use and carry case.
So you think that's what makes the distinction? So you're not asking us to overrule Palladino?
I'm not asking you. We are not asking to overrule Palladino. We were just asking.
Well, you don't care if we do.
That would be fine with me, too. But I submit that that is a difference that is significant in this case. We'd ask the court to vacate the sentence on count 5, I believe it is, the 25-year consecutive sentence. Thank you.
May it please the court.
I'm here.
Yes, ma'am. I'm here arguing for Nicholas Cejas, who was the co-defendant in the case prior argued by my co-counsel. In this case, with regard to Nicholas Cejas, there's actually three arguments that we are putting forth before the court. We're arguing that the poll camera that was admitted into evidence in this case was improperly admitted, and because it was admitted, it provided a prejudicial impact that outweighed its probative value. Additionally, we're arguing that the mere presence of Nicholas Cejas at one particular narcotics deal that was testified to at the trial was insufficient to convict him of the offense that he was convicted of in 21 U.S.C. 841 and 846 in count one, as well as possession with the intent to distribute 50 grams or more of methamphetamines under 21 U.S.C. 841A1. Additionally, he was also convicted of count five, possession of a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking, also under 18 U.S.C. 924. And the facts of Nicholas Cejas are very simplistic in this particular case, in my opinion. Nicholas Cejas was at one particular location on November 14, 2011, that location being the home of Denny, who was the target of an investigation for methamphetamine deals. As testified at trial, Nicholas Cejas merely provided his brother transportation from Indianapolis, Indiana, to Terre Haute, Indiana, at the request of Constantino Cejas. As the record showed, on February the 8th of that same year, 6 days prior, Constantino Cejas was at the home of Mr. Denny when a drug deal was done. He left his home and suffered car malfunctioning there in Terre Haute, Indiana. His car was impounded, and it was working improperly, and he had to find another way from Terre Haute back to Indianapolis. 6 days later, he was summoned back to Denny's home, as the evidence showed, and during that trip, he needed transportation, so he inquired amongst his brother Nicholas to provide him transportation. Nicholas was an individual who owned a landscaping company and as such had all of the tools and acumens of a landscaper, and that he had a pickup truck and lots of tools, lawnmowers, and cutting equipment to help assist him in his landscaping business that he had owned for about 15 years. There was a poll camera set up outside the target's home, the target again being Mr. Denny. That poll camera was fixed on a pole and was pointed directly with his lens facing Mr. Denny's home. The poll camera was monitored at a separate location by Agent Wheel. Agent Wheel could see what the poll camera showed him, but he was not present at the location of Denny's home.
Yeah. Do you have any case law to support your position that an eyewitness to the actual scene is required to admit the video versus an agent who is looking at the live feed through the camera?
Judge, in fact, I think I quote the case of United States versus Fluker when this court examined and ruled 901A. In that particular case, it wasn't talking about a camera necessarily. It was talking about emails. In the Fluker case.
Right, but this is a visual. So there's a big difference in him sitting there with a live feed, seeing actually what's going on at the time, even though I understand the live feed, the camera angle switched. And so sometimes it wasn't exactly on the scene, but I mean, that case isn't really that helpful, in my opinion.
Yes, ma'am. And Judge, what I point out is that not only was there was this live feed, but this live feed was not accurate, as testified by Agent Will. There was testimony that there were more than 30 seconds of footage missing from this tape. So the purpose of having someone live there that can testify as to what was actually happening, I think, is very germane.
Because but doesn't that objection really go to the weight, not admissibility?
Judge, I think it goes to both the weight and the admissibility, and that's part of the argument, because we believe it was the prejudicial effect of that was certainly outweighed by any probative value, because it left the jury with the belief, or at least the wrong interpretation or the invited speculation, that more was happening at that scene than what the video actually depicted.
Because you're in your rebuttal time, you know. You're into your rebuttal time, which is all right with me, but I just want you to know.
And I'll finish up the last statement, and I'll remain the rest of my time for rebuttal. It was important to note that there was no testimony that Mr. Seha, Nicholas Seha, ever possessed any weapons, drugs, or money, as testified by all the witnesses, and was not seen on video with any of that same contraband. Thank you.
All right. Mr. McCoskey.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This Court should affirm the judgments with respect to both defendants, the judgments of conviction, and as well as the sentence. With respect to the first appellant, Mr. Sejas, I'd like to, as an initial matter, briefly address something that came up in a reply brief filed by the appellant, Mr. Sejas, where he disputes that, in essence, the trial attorney at sentencing agreed with the mandatory minimum sentencing that's at issue here. The sentencing transcript at page 5 indicates that Mr. Ansel, who is the trial attorney, in fact stated he is subject to a statutory minimum of 40 years. And then counsel argued that in light of the 3553A factors, that the defendant should get no more than a mandatory minimum, and that's what the government agreed with. And not only did the government agree with it, but reiterated the breakdown that count 3 would be the 5-year consecutive sentence for the first 924C conviction, and then count 5 would be 25 years consecutive to those two. That's as clear as it gets. And the district court then even told the defendant, look, Congress intended this. This is what you're going to get. That was every opportunity that the defense could have had, should have had, to object or somehow raise an argument at that sentencing phase to preserve this. But even if this is not a waived issue, Your Honor, even if this court proceeds with a plain error review, which it should, and not a de novo review, there is no error, plain or otherwise, in the way in which the 924C counts were charged against Mr. Sejas, the way in which the jury was instructed with respect to those counts, the way in which he was found guilty of those counts, and, of course, the way in which the court sentenced Mr. Sejas for those two counts. 924C, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Westerfield. It's not ambiguous in any respect. As Judge Sykes pointed out, I think it's pretty clear that in drafting this statute, Congress set forth a clear separation of a prohibited act, in this case possession, that must be tied to a predicate drug trafficking act, in this case. That was exactly how it was charged and proven in this case, and the jury was instructed as to the separate two predicate substantive drug trafficking acts at issue here, the one on February 8th and then, of course, the one on February 14th.
What is it about Mr. Cejas, Constantino Cejas, either his background or his convictions, his package of convictions in this case, that justifies a 40-year sentence?
Your Honor,
I mean, you were in the driver's seat. The prosecution's totally in the driver's seat about whether to charge that second. Apart from the double jeopardy issue, which you're right is resolved by our case law and the language of the statute, but why charge the second to tack on an additional 25 years? Did you really need 40 years on this case?
Your Honor, whether or not it's, I would respectfully say that it's not a matter of what he needs.
That's my question.
Okay.
Why does the government, what governmental interest is served by locking this guy up for 40 years?
I think that the government's interest, and I should clarify, Your Honor, I was not in the driver's seat below. And
okay,
I don't
whoever
think this is
was, you know, it's your office that's responsible for
yes,
this prosecution, and whatever decision-making went on to charge that second gun charge, knowing that it meant a consecutive mandatory sentence of 25 years. Why did you need that kind of exposure to protect the public from this defendant?
Well, Your Honor, I think Congress is pretty clear in
okay,
setting
forth. I'm asking you for your prosecutorial judgment. I know what Congress said, but you're in the driver's seat, your office, in deciding what to charge. The judge had no choice here
yes,
but to impose that sentence. So this was an exclusively executive branch decision, not a congressional decision or a judicial decision. Why is this a justifiable sentence?
Your Honor, and with all respect, the reason why I was bringing up congressional intent is when Congress speaks as to the seriousness of an offense, that has to enter
you
into
you exercise
the
prosecutorial discretion all day long.
Yes,
that's your job.
Honor. And that's part of it. That's part of it. We, you know, some crimes are more serious than others. Some
why
crimes
is this
must
one more serious than others?
Because any time a firearm, Your Honor, I would say is at issue in a case, in particular in drug trafficking, it's going to be more serious.
So every time you can charge, you're going to charge?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think
that's what you just told me.
Well, I think it's a factor that has to be considered in prosecution.
So is it your position that if a defendant is convicted on 10 drug charges and possessed a gun each time, it would be permissible and mandatory to sentence him to 9 consecutive 25-year sentences? So if there had been another sale, you would have just tacked on and it would have been another 25 years?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that it would be permissible under 924C for that to be the case.
Yeah, and that's the question. So, but what sense does that make?
Is it your position that's totally discretionary?
It's a prosecutor is always going to have that discretion in what to charge.
So it's always discretionary.
In this case, it was discretionary. Sure.
Is it
so
you just
exercise your discretion?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, that it's my place to say whether it's just or not. It's only in this.
That is your place. That's part of the exercise of discretion. I'm surprised to hear you disclaim that.
Well, no, Your Honor, I didn't mean to just say that we punt whenever something, when an issue presents itself as just or unjust. What I mean, Your Honor, is in this case, what was charged was absolutely correct under these facts.
I don't dispute that.
I'm asking you, it's
a justice-based question.
I see, a law-based question.
What was his criminal history?
His criminal history category, I believe, was a Category 1, Your Honor. So
category
he was,
one, which is the lowest
correct.
Criminal history category.
Yes, Your
which
Honor.
Which means that he had no convictions, or if there might have been a little misdemeanor or something like that to qualify as a 1.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So how does that get to... I mean, there was no money beaten with a pistol. The firearm was not fired. It wasn't, like, taken from him and then, like, an agent was murdered or injured or something.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the statute makes no distinction with respect to the criminal history category or the guidelines calculation.
The statute doesn't do that. But in terms of the charging, and I understand, as Judge Bauer pointed out, this is a discretionary call by the government.
Yes,
the government. We're just trying to discern here, looking from our standpoint, a criminal category 1 in 40 years. How does that make any sense?
Your Honor, it makes sense because it was permissible and it was just. I don't know what
is there
the
a
prosecutor...
Is there a severe problem in Terre Haute with collateral violence from the meth trade? That might be an important factor in the exercise of prosecutorial discretion about whether to go for 40 years with this guy.
Your Honor, I know that that is an area of special emphasis in our office. There's FBI resident agency that's
out there. Is there a problem of collateral gun violence associated with the meth trade in Terre Haute?
Throughout the Southern District of Indiana, Your Honor, I would say that's true.
Did the judge have discretion, or was he bound by your discretionary move?
The judge has discretion to sentence within whatever the advisory guideline range is, Your Honor.
But of course, did the judge have discretion in this case to sentence below your recommendation?
No, Your Honor.
Right.
No.
So Congress just transferred the judicial discretion to the prosecutorial discretion. I'm not quarreling with it. I'm just saying, in your opinion, that's what happened.
Well, Your Honor, in my opinion, the prosecutorial team must have weighed all of the relevant factors in exercising.
I was at both the prosecutorial section and the judicial section, so I'm not quarreling with it. I'm just asking if that's the position.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It is my position. And because of that, Your Honor, I think, I recognize other courts have called results like this, maybe like this, draconian.
Yeah.
But it's not.
That maybe, yeah. I mean, it is draconian. It is draconian. First time offender, guns not fired, agents not killed, nothing that has to do with this particular ring, lots of murders that, you know, were committed by this particular meth ring. It is draconian. So, obviously, the court's hands were bound. Our hands are bound on that aspect of it, but it certainly is not a good message, and you can certainly convey to your office, this doesn't sit well with us. It doesn't have any, we don't have any control on that, but it just makes no sense.
I certainly
came before a very kindly court, you can tell.
I understand.
You can spread that word around, though.
With respect, if I may address another aspect of Mr. Seha's argument, the comparison of the possession act, the prohibited act in 922G with possession in this case, or in a 924C case, I think it's not apposite because, as Judge Sykes alluded, the unit of prosecution is kind of built into 924C. It's built in by tying the possession to an act in furtherance of a particular predicate act. And, of course, 922G is a status offense, does not have that. So, to me, Your Honor, the statute is clear. It led to this result, but it's a sustainable result under the law, Your Honor.
So there's this new initiative the Attorney General has announced about crime, and where this kind of situation with first-time offenders is going to be reviewed. I hope your office reads that.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, we are very well aware of what the Attorney General put out recently with respect to charging and sentencing decisions. And I can't say that this case would have been charged this way had that policy been implemented before this case came up. But as it stands, Your Honor, I would say that the sentence should be sustained for the reasons I've given and that we've briefed. With respect to Mr. Seha's arguments, Your Honor, talk first about the poll cam. The poll cam evidence that is challenged here did not come in a vacuum. I think the court should be very clear on that. The footage on the 14th of 2011, February 14, 2011, that's at issue here, came in after the court had already admitted evidence of video evidence, that is, from February 8th, as well as photographs, still photographs from that poll cam footage on February 8th. Also, the jury had heard testimony from agents who conducted physical surveillance of the scene, specifically Mr. Seha's car that looked like a police car. So the fact is, I think that the jury, putting aside the objection that was raised in the trial and it's reiterated here, the jury could take into account the fact that this other stuff had come in before, that it's been properly authenticated, the district court made the right decision on that, and could conclude ultimately in weighing the evidence that Mr. Seha should be found guilty of the charges with which he was crimed and the crimes with which he was charged. And I would say that Mr. Seha has not come close to establishing or meeting the standard to overturn a reasonable jury's verdict with respect to any of the counts. So this court should affirm. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, how much time? 3 minutes? I don't know how you all want to split it.
Oh,
okay.
I just got a few comments. We've made twofold argument, a double jeopardy argument, but also a statutory interpretation argument. So the unit of prosecution may not be relevant to the intention, the statutory intention or legislative intent argument. Secondly, I would note that the possession in furtherance was adopted in response to the Bailey decision. When Congress expanded it to possession, that gave, you know, they didn't say during or in relations, they said in furtherance. And they intentionally used different language. We would submit that it is not only draconian, unreasonable to say you can, for each time there's a delivery made, the gun back at the house, he can be charged with another 924C offense. And
the,
that's
the
our
Bailey
position.
Amendment, though, didn't change the unit of prosecution. It may
it
have
did
changed
not,
the
it did
facts
not change the unit of prosecution.
Permissible for a conviction, but it didn't change the unit of prosecution.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honor. And two final points. As far as Nicholas Seha, my client, it should be noted that there was no photographic evidence from the video on February 8, 2011 that depicted him at the home of Denny. Mr. Seha, Nicholas Seha, was only at that residence on one singular occasion, and it is that one singular occasion that led to his indictment, arrest, and conviction for these charges. And it was the evidence only from that video that showed him there. It should be noted that there was no testimony at trial from Mr. Denny, from any of the other witnesses, the Trotton sisters, that indicated they'd never met Mr. Seha on any prior occasions. They'd never purchased drugs or from him on any prior occasion. They'd never seen him with a weapon because they'd never seen him before at all in life prior to the trial. So Mr. Seha, Nicholas Seha, is being convicted on these charges for merely his mere presence at the home of Denny on February 14, 2011. Thank you.
My memory correct that these two are brothers?
That is correct, Your Honor.
What was the, how did their father spell his name?
If I may, Your Honor, anecdotally there were some discussions about that, and we believe that may have been a Scrivener's error that did not get corrected by interlineation.
An error where?
There was a Scrivener's error at the time of filing the charges. I believe the correct pronunciation, spelling of the name has an S at the end of both of their names.
Oh.
But
so
somehow.
Your guy's proceeding under an alias here.
No, Your Honor, he was not. I believe that was just a Scrivener's error at the time of filing
okay.
the charges.
And just so I'm clear, Nicholas drove to Denny's house with Constantino, accessed the toolbox, went into the house, went back to the toolbox, and drove away. And the toolbox contained the $8,000 and the gun when the FBI pulled him over a few minutes later.
I would respectfully disagree with that characterization, Your Honor. He was seen by the poll camera standing next to the truck on the passenger side, and it is believed by the officer that the toolbox may have been open, but there was no evidence to show he ever accessed the toolbox.
Thank
you for your time, Your Honor.
All right. Were both of you appointed?
Yeah.
All right. We thank you. We thank all counsel for the briefing and the fine argument. We'll take the case under advisement.